Pre-agreements are certainly would be nice, but as soon as one of the commissioners goes, or all four, all 16 of them go in a year, then nobody's going to look at that pre-agreement any more than Exxon Shipping looked at Alyeska's contingency plan.
Bob Loresch apologized several times this morning for seeming cynical, but his testimony before the commission essentially was that no matter what the plan may be, when an emergency strikes, the people in power at the time are just going to deal with the situation. How they deal and what they actually do will depend on individual personalities.
I submit that the governor is the czar in the end, no matter what. And you're going to have governors with different levels of involvement. Not to characterize this one. But, I mean, let's face it, if Wally Hickel had been governor now, you'd have had a czar and it wouldn't have been unclear to anybody.
The Oil Spill Commission, on the other hand, is charged with reporting to the legislature on the spill and making recommendations for just the sort of plans Loresch says won't matter anyway. The commission sees the American Petroleum Institute and the federal government, through legislation now in Congress, making decisions and plans that will affect the state. They're trying to make sure the state also has a voice in the proceedings. It's a problem Loresch saw, too, as he dealt with Exxon and the Coast Guard through the summer.
Both Admiral Robbins and Admiral Yost speak of the state in the following sense. They say, well, no, we have involvement from everybody. We have the Coast Guard, we have EPA, we have NOAA, we have Fish and Wildlife Service, we have the National Park Service, and we have the state of Alaska. They put our sovereign government on the same level as individual federal agencies.
Loresch saw his major job in the oil spill crisis to be an agent of the governor, smoothing the paths between state and federal agencies, the public and industry. For the most part, he was able to work things out, but it was a process of constant negotiations. Some he thought were bizarre, like the problem with workmen's compensation. It's state law that a person buying a service cannot pay a contractor for the service until the Department of Labor certifies that the contractor is paid up on workman's comp.
Well, the other day, Exxon agreed to reimburse the city of Angoon for their costs of shipping fish up to some villages in Prince William Sound. They got a notice from Department of Labor that put a lien on that money and required that it be paid to Department of Labor instead of Angoon, because Angoon hadn't bothered to have a workman's comp account. So, you know, we had to deal with this. Basically, Exxon asked for help to allow them to spend money.
Changes in the law affecting those specific problems, Loresch says, wouldn't make a difference in another emergency. The problems would just be different. There are lessons, though, he says, that must be learned, and he's been telling everyone, including Exxon.
If we don't fix the tanker safety problem, fix these shipping companies, and if we don't fix Alyeska and ensure that the API's pyro organizations are something more than Alyeska has been, then we haven't gained a thing from all this torture.
The Oil Spill Commission will make its final report to the legislature in January. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
As far as response to the oil spill went, we went for 3 or 4 days there with no response from Alyeska on a plan that they thought they could clean up 200,000 barrel oil spill in 48 hours. We have some very glaring problems there, and I think they need to be addressed.
Take the pressure off the Coast Guard so that we can do a first-class job.
Well, how much money will you...
Let me finish, Mr. Chairman. And I think that the proof is in what we witnessed over the last decade. We've watched the Coast Guard have to retreat in Prince William Sound, ignore the recommendations of the state and of the local people and of the fishermen for budgetary reasons.
A House Merchant Marine Subcommittee heard testimony on what's called the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Reform Act. The bill's sponsor is California Congressman George Miller, a fierce critic of the oil industry's handling of the Exxon Valdez incident. Miller proposes that tighter oversight of the pipeline system be tied to oil spill liability and compensation legislation making its way through the House. Some of that oversight, as well as prevention and response, would be paid for by a trust fund capitalized by a 5-cent-a-barrel fee on oil pumped through the system. It would replace the current fund, generate about $30 million annually, and would be in addition to a proposed $1 billion national fund. In an exchange with committee chairman Billy Tozan, Miller argued the national fund alone won't do the job.
I do not have confidence in that fund, in that fund's ability to generate the kinds of revenues that'll... So yes, with 25% of our oil, our domestic oil, coming through that sound, I have no problem suggesting that there should be a trust fund there.
Critics of the Miller bill argued a unified fund, not multiple funds, would be most effective. They also argued the Alaska Oil Fund would be discriminatory because it would only cover problems in Alaska and the West Coast. To get around the problem, Alaska Congressman Don Young broke ranks with the Bush administration and made this suggestion.
Why can't even this administration recognize the value of a 5-cent tax across the board, everybody being responsible as users of oil and gas and petroleum products imported into this nation? Accept that. In fact, I believe they would accept it. We have a responsibility. And under the parent bill, this doesn't just apply to the Alaskan oil. It applies to all oil. And then we eliminate this battle over the two funds. I know some people are going to say, well, you want us to have a state preemption, et cetera, et cetera. I'm suggesting we're liable to end up with no bill at all if we continue bickering.
But Young's proposal would likely meet more than administration opposition. The House Ways and Means Committee, which handles tax matters, opposes increasing taxes as long as the administration does. Beyond the funding issue, the Miller bill cracks down on pipeline operations. For example, it calls for a presidential task force to audit, review, and direct operation of the pipeline system. James Hermiller, chief operating officer of Alyeska Pipeline Company, said there's no need for Miller's bill.
It's unnecessary to add another layer of government control to an already highly regulated facility. It is unfair to tax one resource to support programs having nationwide benefits.
But Jeff Gard of Cordova District Fishermen United said the Miller bill is needed to make Alyeska live up to its promises.
For best available technology, we have a ballast water treatment system that is determined by EPA to be the worst available option in subarctic environments. We have a vapor recovery system that is virtually non-functional.
There's likely to be a lot of backroom negotiating on the Miller bill and other measures members want to see in oil spill liability and compensation legislation. The whole package is tentatively scheduled for debate on the House floor early next week. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C. The 275-page report is based on direct observation of the oil spill response and historical research into preparedness. Center President Roger McManus says the response effort is best summed up by a phrase he heard in Valdez, chaos and cosmetics.
This was, of course, a horrible accident. It was an accident that we were supposed to be prepared for, that we were assured that we were prepared for, and that we would be able to respond to effectively. That did not happen. There were a lot of major efforts by very well-meaning and industrious people. Agencies and industry did come together, but the evidence of lack of preparedness, lack of having equipment available, lack of authority, lack of coordination, all led to major delays and problems that we've witnessed over the months.
The report aims special criticism at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and its parent department, Interior. Roger McManus.
The service was slow in responding, and they did not use existing authority that they had to respond and help in preventing damages to wildlife and recovering damaged wildlife and helping to restore them to health.
McManus says funding was a problem for the Interior Department, but says difficulties ran deeper than that.
Lack of initiative on Interior's part was very disturbing. And looking for communications regarding directives for the oil spill with regard to Interior, we were unable to find any formal communications through a Freedom of Information request from Interior to the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Park Service. There were no directives, as far as we know, and we were told by the Secretary's Office of the Department of the Interior that they had no written directives of that nature.
The report draws up a long list of recommendations to avoid or handle future oil spills. Many of the things the report suggests will be in House legislation scheduled for debate early next week. But Roger McManus argues a critical element, federal direction over cleanups, could be missing.
There is no substitute for a single leader. We cannot have the spiller be responsible for cleaning up the spill. It's a nice idea. It doesn't work.
McManus says, above all, the report shows the U.S. is a long way from being able to protect coasts from future spills as big as the Exxon Valdez accident. For Alaska Public Radio, I'm Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
There were a lot of major efforts by very well-meaning and industrious people. Agencies and industry did come together, but the evidence of lack of preparedness, lack of having equipment available, lack of authority, lack of coordination, all led to major delays and problems that we've witnessed over the months. We were unable to find any formal communications through Freedom of Information requests from Interior to the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Park Service. There were no directives, as far as we know, and we were told by the Secretary's Office of the Department of the Interior that they had no written directives of that nature.
Reports of oil began trickling in Tuesday afternoon after the Navy removed one of its deflection booms in the area. An Exxon flight over Chinigan and Sawmill Bay reported seeing only kelp, no oil. A Coast Guard flight that evening couldn't report anything definite because of the dim light. On Wednesday, the Coast Guard sent a pollution investigator to look over the situation. He wasn't able to land, but Coast Guard Commander Scott Jones, assistant to the on-scene coordinator in Valdez, says they did see oil.
They found only one small, thin sheen in the northeastern part of the bay. It was about 100 feet by 100 feet. It wasn't large enough really to be cleaned up. It was very small, very thin. We've also had some reports that some of the villagers there have seen some moose patties wash up on the beach. Our plan is right now is to continue to investigate to see if there is material coming off one of the previously treated beaches and getting into the bay, or further define the situation.
The Coast Guard was able to get an investigator on the scene today.
We're operating under the assumption that it is related to the Exxon Valdez. We don't actually know that for a fact at this point.
There have also been reports of boats in the area, and some are speculating oil may have come from them somehow. There's still one boom in place at Sawmill Bay, but as winter approaches, it will be taken away too. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard is checking each report of oil that may be related to the Exxon Valdez. Commander Jones.
Right now we're just trying to identify how much oil is actually getting into Sawmill Bay and what the source is.
For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
During the months following the March 24th blackening of Prince William Sound, Admiral Robbins became known as a straightforward and practical executive willing to speak his mind. When asked if he had enough authority under current law to do his job, he didn't mind giving a straight answer.
There definitely should be more, I think, authority vested in the federal on-scene coordinator if we really want him to do his job.
The Admiral arrived in Prince William Sound in response to a direct order from Commandant Paul Yost. He wasn't sure he was the right man for the job. His last oil spill experience had been 15 years before in Galveston.
But I got up here and found that nothing had changed. It was just like it was 15 years ago, still using the same rudimentary methods. We didn't have the equipment that was necessary. Everybody was looking at everybody else, and I thought they were all looking at me to tell them how this was supposed to be done.
The Admiral was generally complimentary of the way Exxon handled the spill. He cited several examples where the company went to great lengths to make the cleanup effective, hiring an entire French factory to make fertilizer to encourage bacterial consumption of the oil, and bringing in massive numbers of steam cleaning rigs in just 2 days. But asked about the slowness of the initial response, he was more equivocal about Exxon.
Were they slow in responding? It felt awful slow. You know, when you're sitting there trying to get things done, it seems awfully slow. Skimmers were slow in getting here. I think they did the best with what they had to work with.
Robin said it's easy to underestimate the difficulties of getting a cleanup mobilized in a place that's 50 miles from anywhere. And in the same way, it's not easy to know the best time to begin shutting such an operation down.
They probably had 6,000-7,000 people that were on the water out there working. They were in hotel barges that weren't made for heavy weather. A good windstorm gave me sleepless nights, I'll tell you. So I think it was a good decision. They might have been able to stretch it a few more days, but having just lost a tug, I'm glad we finished when we did.
The Admiral says he's also confident Exxon will come back and do what's necessary to resume the cleanup in the spring. He called it more of a rifle shot next time instead of an all-out assault.
Are the beaches clean? No, they're not clean. When you spill that much oil that's as tenacious as crude oil is on the beach, there's going to be some of it there for a lot of years. We will be monitoring it during the winter and seeing where it's moving around. If it moves at all, we hope that it won't. We will see some movement, undoubtedly, and looking at these shorelines to see what needs to be done. And then what I expect in the spring will that Exxon will be back and take more of a rifle approach. Instead of the hordes of thousands out there beating up on the beaches, we will try to zero in on those areas that need attention and use a more tactical approach rather than a strategic approach.
Admiral Clyde Robbins, the federal on-scene coordinator for the Exxon Valdez spill, said he had a tear in his eye as he left Valdez for the last time. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
It's ironic that the ship that ran aground on March 24th was named the Exxon Valdez, because the oil spill is always referred to with a Valdez name attached. Members of the tourism industry blame that for an awful lot of bad press. Steve Hall of the Westmark.
I think on the national scene, it's not Prince William Sound at all. It's just Valdez. I mean, should have been the Exxon Long Beach or something, you know? I mean, you know, whatever, just the wrong name.
People complain that the press has reported no rooms available, a tent city atmosphere, and a high crime rate, all of which hurt the city's image. But Marilyn Talmadge of the Village Inn says the community has to admit those things were true and deal with them. More importantly, Talmadge says, is the need to be able to say that Prince William Sound is no longer oiled.
I was last Friday on the north end of Seal Island, where I saw growth contamination. So I'm no expert on the Sound, believe me. On the other hand, I have a totally different perception from as recently as last Friday about whether or not the Sound is our Sound has been cleaned up.
Numbers quoted by all involved in the tourism industry in Valdez show significant drops. Joe Leahy, director of the local museum, reports that donated revenues, which had grown from $2,000 to $20,000 between 84 and 88, were down to $11,000 this year. And he says visitor numbers were down by half as well.
We did, out of 49 ship visits this year, we did only 13,000 people. Last year, out of 39 visits, 10 fewer ships called, we did 19,500 people. Road traffic numbers are the same also.
Nancy Lethko of the Alaska Wilderness Saline Safaris says the adventure travel business she did have this summer suffered from the noise pollution of increased air traffic and radio chatter, as well as from a loss of anchorage areas due to oil contamination and overcrowding in the places that were available. Lethko charges that the role of the Division of Tourism needs reconsideration.
The fisheries industry had strong support for resource protection from the Department of Fish and Game. We never heard anyone in the Division of Tourism discussing the need for protecting tourism-related resources. We believe that too much emphasis is placed on the Division of Tourism as a marketing agency. They should also be charged with protecting tourism-related resources.
Another idea suggested is for the establishment of an interpretive center that can teach visitors about the oil spill, the cleanup, and the results of ongoing studies of the spill's effects. It's hoped that such a center would keep people coming to Valdez in the future. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The state economy may have been given a boost by all the money spent to clean up the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but at least one economist doesn't think it will add up to the jumpstart that many have been seeking. In fact, a match on Social Security numbers done by the State Labor Department shows as many as a quarter of the thousands of people who went to work on the spill cleanup effort came from outside the state. Jeff Kennedy reports.
Labor economist Holly Stinson has tracked the short-term effects on the state economy.
There was a payroll this summer of over $200 million is the word on the street. So, of course, there's a $200 million out on the street that wasn't there. Now, some of that is not, it's not all necessarily in-state. There can be some out-of-staters that are taking some of that money with them. But that's definitely a shot in the arm, and there will definitely be continued shots in the arm with those same people collecting their unemployment, if indeed they do collect unemployment.
Stinson says state officials match Social Security numbers of workers with permanent fund dividend applications and mailing addresses to determine that 10 to 25% of the workforce came from other states. She expects some of those non-residents to stick around for possible cleanup jobs next year, and others to fill the jobs left vacant by workers who sought higher-paying cleanup jobs this year. Stinson says the spill provided 6,000 temporary jobs. That compares to 10,000 jobs lost in the construction industry alone in the recession that struck the state 3 years ago.
It may have a very small effect, especially in the areas affected by the spill. But when you're talking about a significant effect in the long run, 2, 3, 5 years down the road, I don't see how it could possibly have much effect on the statewide economy.
I asked if environmental damage could offset the short-term gains with long-term losses.
The environmental effects are certainly the big unknown still right now. And fishing, you know, as we know for this year, was actually not all that bad, although certain areas were closed and it hit certain areas harder than others. But those people that were not fishing, many of them were getting dollars in their pockets by chartering their boats to Exxon. So for this year, economically, they didn't do as bad as we at first, you know, thought, everyone thought they might. But in the long run, that is the big question. What fishing's going to look like 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, when we start seeing what happens to this year's fry coming back as adults, you know, how many there'll be and what quality there'll be.
Stinson says the spill also created a few permanent jobs on tugs that now have to accompany tankers in Prince William Sound, in watchdog agencies like the State Department of Environmental Conservation, and in research on the long-term environmental effects of the spill. In Kotzebue, I'm Jeff Kennedy.
There's a lot of money floating around, a lot of televisions being bought and that sort of thing. Maybe that's great. I hope they use it wisely. But what I see more people doing is taking off for the lower 48 for long vacations.
Trustees for Alaska attorneys Eric Smith and Randall Weiner point to the fact that the state sold the leases without a thorough examination of the impacts. They told the court the state didn't even specify how the oil would be transported, and if there's no pipeline in the Arctic Refuge, it's pretty hard to imagine how it would be done. Assistant Attorney General Francis Neville argued that state law does not require everything to be nailed down before a lease is sold, and an industry attorney pointed to three boxes of files on the federal Beaufort Sea sale, saying when the leases were sold, the file was only 140 pages, and still not a drop of oil has been produced there. Trustee's argument relied heavily on the idea that the state has no way of stopping development once it's sold a lease. That was undermined when Neville pointed to the lease document itself, which says the state can cancel the leases if it finds serious damage to the environment could result. The court took the arguments under advisement with no word when it will rule on Camden Bay. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
As we begin speaking about things that have been important to us, we've taken that from a grassroots level and we've watched it develop into legislation that's actually being introduced right now.
First of all, there weren't enough dispersants available. The manner in which you'd have to spray them on, 250,000 barrels of oil, is very complicated, and the capability just isn't there. I doubt if it would have made much difference.
It's very disrupting to hear our legislators, our people that represent us, refer to us as a small fraction of people known as tree huggers or bunny lovers. And that's not true. And what we've done with the Oil Reform Alliance is form a group which is representative of the people of Alaska. And we're just not a handful of environmental groups. We've reached out far beyond that.
Stephen said he understands that there is still anger over the spill in Alaska, but Alaskans must find a balance with the risks the oil industry involves, and he hopes they don't turn against oil drilling in the Arctic Refuge. The Exxon president said no company tanker procedures have been changed as a result of the spill because the problem came from procedures not being followed and chance.
We and everyone else should now have a renewed respect for what chance can do when it zeroes in on a target.
That did not go down too well with Alaska Environmental Conservation Commissioner Denny Kelso.
This was not a chance occurrence. The spill was completely avoidable. Instead, we need to learn from it, and we need to learn how we can prevent spills from happening.
Stevens said the spill has been a bad dream for Exxon. Kelso said it's one that's continuing for many in Alaska. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
Hundreds of consumers, retailers, and wholesalers of Alaska seafoods were interviewed in the United States, France, Britain, and Japan beginning in May. ASME wanted to determine what the level of awareness was about the oil spill and to see how it affected perceptions of Alaskan seafood. Survey results indicated the oil spill did not affect purchases. In some countries, respondents said they had reduced or eliminated purchases of Alaskan seafood, but because of taste preference or high prices. Program quality coordinator Kevin O'Sullivan says ASME used the survey information to build an informational program. It gave updates on fisheries taking place in Alaska and gave results of inspection programs. O'Sullivan says ASME sent out 20,000 reports to trades each month all summer.
We're trying not to point to the spill a lot out in the trade. We're trying to let business as usual, resume and move the shoes back and get going with the business at hand here.
O'Sullivan says for the trades and consumers, the main reasons cited for believing Alaskan seafood was safe were the state and federal inspection programs. ASME's informational program had stressed how once an area was opened for harvest, vessels, gear, equipment, and the catch were scrutinized by DEC inspectors, which increased threefold statewide and 12-fold in Prince William Sound.
I believe because of the efforts that the state undertook and continues to undertake, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and DEC, in their surveillance work and beefed up inspection program, that confidence, that consumer confidence, is there.
The Institute is now preparing its strategy for worldwide marketing of Alaska's $3 billion wholesale seafood industry for next year. O'Sullivan says the fact that the Exxon Valdez oil spill didn't negatively affect public perception of Alaska's seafood makes their job much easier.
Well, it is good news, and it's the kind of news that I know the entire industry coming off of a tough season. It was a good harvest, but it was a difficult season. We're anxious. We've got programs in place, and we're very excited to get out there and get the message out there about Alaska seafood again this year. And we've got some good product out there. And I think we're just going to get on now with the business of selling seafood.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
When protesters twice interrupted his speech, William Stevens said he didn't mind. He understands there's anger in Alaska. His employees have felt it, and the spill is something they all regret.
Exxon regrets. We deeply regret what happened.
The Exxon president said his company has made a good faith effort to set things right, and he hopes Alaskans don't turn against the oil industry. He said Exxon's spending on the spill exceeds $1 billion now, though he admitted it's all tax deductible.
Under U.S. tax law, any ordinary and necessary business expense is deductible. Exxon will file its tax return in accordance with the laws of the land. But anybody that thinks that means this doesn't cost us doesn't understand what the tax laws are.
Stevens has been to Alaska 5 times, but this was his first public speech here since the spill. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel. The large ballroom of the Anchorage Hilton Hotel was filled to capacity for the first public speech in Alaska by the Exxon president. The crowd was perhaps a little too large. Protesters in the audience twice disrupted the speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm... leaving the room. In some ways, I'm glad that happened. It's the very least that I can do as president of Exxon Company USA, come forward and, if you will, face people who do truly have a high degree of upset with us.
At the same time, Stevens said, Alaska has to find its balance with the oil industry. A third of America's undiscovered oil reserves are thought to exist in Alaska, and Congress has yet to decide whether to allow oil activity in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
I feel it will be neither in this state's interest nor in the national interest if the passions aroused by Valdez were to preclude a rational resolution.
Stevens said the spill was like a bad dream for Exxon, but the company has not sought to dodge its responsibility to deal with it. So far, he said, spending on the spill exceeds $1 billion, and if studies show more cleanup will help more than hurt the shoreline, Exxon will do it.
If, based on that review, the federal on-scene coordinator requests that Exxon undertake additional reasonable work, we'll do so.
The Exxon president said he was not ready to blame the spill on alcohol, and several times he called it a chance event.
We and everyone else should now have a renewed respect for what chance can do when it zeroes in on a target.
Stevens said the oil industry in general is going to be looking harder at prevention, and that will raise costs. Asked more specifically whether Exxon had seen fit to change any of its practices aboard its tankers, Stevens said no.
We had a procedural aberration here. Something happened that shouldn't have happened. Procedures weren't followed, but the procedures were sound. The instructions were sound. They just weren't followed.
Alaska Environmental Conservation Commissioner Denny Kelso was not satisfied with what he heard from the Exxon president.
I understood that Mr. Stevens had characterized the spill as a bad dream for him and for Exxon. And I can understand that. I think it's been a nightmare for all of us. It's important to remember, though, that for the Alaskans whose communities have been affected by the spill, that bad dream is the reality they wake up to every day.
Kelso says he agrees that cleanup operations should not resume where they'll do more harm than good, but he'd like to see Exxon doing more to develop new cleanup technology.
We certainly have not suggested that the same techniques that were used last summer, for example, hot water, high pressure washing of rocks, be used wholesale throughout the area. That wouldn't be appropriate. But we think that this winter is an excellent time to take stock of the methods that have been used and to do the research and development so that we have a much more effective set of methods ready to go next spring.
Stevens did say Exxon is involved in research this winter, but was no more specific about it. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Put out some Mustangs in there. We'll have some emergency equipment for people to use, such as some tents. You know, anybody goes out in a boat, we'll expect them to take some emergency equipment with them. We're providing all of that. We have some single sideband radios, some marine radios that'll be installed in the villages themselves.
We came, did a good job, and spent a lot of money, and I would agree that they did spend a lot of money. What they spent it, whether they spent it effectively or not, is something we're still investigating.
Right now, the commission is doing a risk assessment of Cook Inlet in Prince William Sound, looking at tanker operations and oil spills under many conditions, recommendations on tanker operations that should and should not be permitted, and oil spill response capabilities for both Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound will be a part of the commission's report to the Alaska Legislature. Walt Parker hopes the commission recommendations on tanker safety will be heard by the rest of the country as well.
Certainly, if it's important to protect the Alaska coast, it's equally important in a federal republic to protect the coasts of Washington, Oregon, California, and indeed all the 22 coastal states.
This week, commission members are planning to visit villages affected by the spill, Port Graham and English Bay. Later, they'll be going to Chiniga and villages on Kodiak Island.
One of the major parts of our report will be some profiles on exactly how the spill affected different communities in different ways. We feel this is critically important, especially in dealing with the federal government and the Congress and making clear to them that this spill did have a good deal of human effect, that its effects were not totally environmental.
The Commission's recommendations will most certainly include a call for more research and development of oil spill response. Parker says both the Commission and the Coast Guard realize Exxon was forced to deal in a crisis with results of years of inaction on all sides.
Playing catch-up in the middle of a major spill is not the way to do it, and we'll certainly emphasize that point again in our recommendations.
The Commission will be meeting again November 13th, 14th, and 15th. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
It could be done. The perception that's given by some in the industry that they're, you know, that it's an absolutely unworkable climate is essentially false. There's also a growing perception in the states that Alaska benefited from this spill because of all the money that was spent, something the parts of our business community are enthusiastically promoting, that in a way the spill was good for us because we had this economic boom. Well, there's no free lunch, and while it may have been an economic boom for some, it was still a disaster for others.
I am concerned about the ability to rapidly respond to an oil spill, and we feel that it is the immediate response is critical.
If you're outside and you look at the big picture, $1 billion spent in the state, every state's going to want an oil spill, but it's our job in the study to show the underlying effects that make it not palatable. The mayors were willing to allow $600,000 to go toward the socioeconomic study because they recognized the regional importance, but to then have only $350,000 left to split up amongst the 26 communities as the only money coming from the state of Alaska to municipalities throughout this whole spill process is just not acceptable.
Ice in the shipping lane was the reason Captain Joseph Hazelwood gave for setting a course that would put his ship aground on Bly Reef, creating the worst oil spill in the nation's history. And ever since, many people have been looking for ways to prevent such an accident from happening again. Last month, a situation developed that had the Coast Guard worried.
Near Bly Reef, as a matter of fact, we had two ships outbound, loaded tankers, and one ship inbound, empty, and they were all outside of the traffic lanes maneuvering around ice. We could no longer risk that situation. That was unacceptable.
Lieutenant Commander Tom Falkenstein of the Coast Guard Marine Safety Office in Valdez says the ice flow has been particularly high this year.
Chunks of ice that we've had have been large enough to where they could, I'm not sure they do, but they could pose a threat to the safety of the ships.
Each company with large ships traveling through the Valdez Narrows has come up with its own plan to negotiate through the ice. Some ships proceed in the designated inbound or outbound lane and just maneuver at slower speeds, pushing the ice out of the way. But when they choose to try to maneuver around the ice and go outside the lanes, the Coast Guard now says ice conditions exist and traffic is limited to one way only.
This is in order to give vessels navigating through Valdez Arm the maximum amount of room to maneuver around the ice and at the same time prevent any possibility of a meeting situation to occur between two ships, which would give them something else to have to maneuver around, and we don't want that to happen.
Once ice conditions are declared, traffic is one way only for the next 24 hours. If another ship goes through, say 6 hours later, and also must go out of the regular lanes to avoid ice, a new 24-hour period begins.
So it can be self-perpetuating and continue on until they no longer have to maneuver around the ice.
And that's what has the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company concerned. George Jerkowicz, Corporate Director of Corporate Affairs at Alyeska, says they're all for tanker safety. But if traffic is stalled too long, it could mean trouble for the pipeline terminal.
You have a limited amount of storage capacity, and you rely on a regular flow of tanker traffic to take away the oil that's pumped through the pipeline at a regular rate. And if at a point your tanks are full and you don't have vessels able to come in and to take additional oil from the pipeline, then you have an impact on the pipeline's throughput.
Jerkowicz says it would take a series of circumstances all piling up in the right order to actually affect the movement of oil, but the possibility exists. Ice conditions shouldn't be too much of a problem through the winter, though. Falkenstein says there are usually many more ice chunks in the spring and summer. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
Texaco representative Pete Nelson says her company is negotiating with other oil companies to coordinate drilling the wells. Shell Western E&P Incorporated finished drilling one well 75 nautical miles north of Point Lay last month and plans to drill another exploratory well this fall. Nelson declined to comment more on Texaco's plan, but gave this prepared statement.
We have kicked off our permitting efforts for Texaco operations and are working with our partners to prioritize our well locations and timing.
Texaco representatives met with state and federal officials this Friday and Monday to explain the company's plans for the Chukchi Sea. Thor Cutler attended that meeting. As an environmental field officer for the State Department of Environmental Conservation in Fairbanks, Cutler specializes in reviewing oil spill contingency plans. He reviewed Shell Western's oil spill plan for the Chukchi. The state turned in its review of that plan March 23rd, the day before the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Here's what Cutler says about Texaco's oil spill contingency plan.
This is the same plan and the same equipment. Now two companies are using that equipment station.
So it may be that Shell will be drilling one well, and Shell Western will be drilling one well, and at the same time, Texaco might be drilling another well, and they have one oil spill contingency barge to take care of two possible mishaps. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding.
Wow. What's your reaction to that?
I am concerned about the ability to rapidly respond to an oil spill, and we feel that it is the immediate response is critical. Obviously, if the spill barge is 125 miles away, it will take a certain period of time for that equipment to be within range of use, since most of the equipment is tied directly to the barge. So our concern is in the ability to respond immediately based on the equipment being up to 125 miles away.
Thor Cutler of the Fairbanks DEC office. Texaco Representative Nelson said Cutler's remarks were only partially true and possibly made out of context, but she said further comment would only jeopardize her company's negotiations with other oil companies. In Kotzebue, I'm Jeff Kennedy.
Anchorage has become the center of the spill response efforts for the winter. The Coast Guard and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have moved their crews into a vacant bank building downtown. The weekly federal on-scene coordinator meetings under Admiral David Cangolini will now be monthly. But the first one this week drew as large a crowd as ever, overflowing the Exxon conference room. Exxon's Don Carpenter says, considering the large number of people mobilized in hazardous conditions, the safety record on the spill has been very good statistically. But the loss of the tug Steadfast last week with all hands aboard has brought about a new focus for the company.
Really most important to us as we begin our safety program or our winter program is safety.
Exxon will stock survival gear and radios with the spill response kits it's leaving in the villages. It will move its field operations to much larger and more powerful vessels, more powerful aircraft, and anyone flying over water will have to undergo winter survival training. A basic winter emphasis for all three sides as cold weather sets in is watching. The state in particular will be keeping an eye out for loose oil, and the Coast Guard says it'll be ready to direct a response to any re-oiling. But the Feds, Exxon, and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation will also each be monitoring pieces of oiled shoreline they have selected to see how weather affects them. Dave Kennedy of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says that includes areas in the Sound and beyond.
One of the things that probably we haven't discussed before we close down for the winter
is a winter studies program that is going to take place outside of Prince William Sound. And we are going to implement that in the Kodiak, Alaska Peninsula, and Kenai Peninsula area starting this month. And we'll periodically then do winter studies programs looking at the progress of the recovery of the beaches over the winter in those areas also.
Exxon, too, has its shoreline segments picked out, according to Bob Mastracchio.
What we wanted to do was to get a sufficient cross-section of the data from different types of shoreline and the initial oiling to formulate an overall picture of the changes taking place over time.
Steve Provant of the state says his crews have a similar effort going.
They're out walking the beaches. The crews are calling it the walkathon.
And Admiral Cangalini is also interested in some beach walking.
We will be on the beaches, walking the shorelines, taking a look at what the oil looks like and monitoring it throughout the winter.
In fact, Cangalini intends to travel to places where oil has been spilled all over the world.
Whether it's in Nova Scotia with a 1 million gallon Bunker C spill or a 50 million gallon spill in France, or a large spill down in the Straits of Magellan down the south of Argentina, or a 2 million gallon spill off of Washington State, what I'm particularly interested is what the condition of the spill is after the wintering and weathering effects of it, what its consistency, and what did those people use to clean it up, and what was the impact to the environment.
What all this beach walking is intended to accomplish is build a case. The state wants Exxon ready to go to work again in the spring. So far, the company has been reluctant to make such commitments, and President Bill Stevens Monday said only that Exxon would comply with reasonable Coast Guard suggestions that had a, quote, net benefit. Exxon's Bob Mastracchio says he is offering to share data with the state. Steve Provant is still undecided about whether to do that. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
One of the main components of Exxon's plan to pay fishermen kept from fishing this summer is the projected harvest. Exxon used past data to average each fisherman's usual share of a season's take and used the projected harvest numbers along with that average to determine payment. That would have worked well had the sockeye harvest for Upper Cook Inlet come anywhere near the projection of 2.5 million fish. In reality, the harvest was 4.9 million, nearly twice the projection, plus an overescapement of more than a million fish into inlet river systems. The Upper Cook Inlet Drifters Association, or UCEDA, has been trying to get Exxon to pay their claims based on the actual number of fish there were, rather than the projected number. UCEDA President Theo Matthews says Exxon has responded to their requests in a favorable way.
Well, the major change is that they've agreed to upgrade the sockeye harvest to 5.9 million compared to the 2.5 million that they paid on to date. So all told, that will increase the area harvest value from $33 million to $72 million. So it's a 115% increase on average gross payment to the fishermen.
In dollars, that means a lot. The average gross payment has been around $35,000. With the new guidelines, the average fisherman will now get about $75,000, and they won't have to sign a release to get it. Exxon has agreed to the fishermen signing receipts only, thereby preserving their option for further claims on the lost season. Matthew says for the most part, UCEDA members are happy with the new deal.
Frankly, I'd have to say we're quite pleased to get this last or next round behind us. We were very concerned about the issue of releases versus non-release. And whether you like the numbers or not, it's enough money to allow people to get on with their lives.
Matthews says, though, he's not ready to call this a final payment. There are still a few items he's concerned about. One of those is the fact that since the Upper Inlet Drifters didn't fish for sockeyes this summer, the competitive edge was taken off the market and prices could have been higher. For now, though, Upper Inlet Drifters can expect to see another sizable check from Exxon by the middle of the month. Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
Until recently, federal regulations on determining a monetary value for wildlife were based on evaluating an animal's use. So a seal was valued at what a seal pelt costs in a store. Using that method, a seal was valued at about $15. A shorebird was determined to be worth a little under $8. Geese were $34.74 each. Those regulations recently were rejected by the U.S. Court of Appeals because of a lawsuit initiated by the National Wildlife Federation. The Federation felt the so-called buck-for-a-duck approach was ridiculous. It said such a method ignored the intrinsic values of wildlife, values that go beyond the price of a pelt. Trustees in charge of the Exxon Valdez oil damage assessment have not yet decided what method to calculate monetary damages, but one study in particular will try to gauge the intrinsic value of wildlife. And beyond figuring the cost of birds, fish, and animals, the study also involves putting a price tag on wilderness. To figure out the dollar value of wilderness, you have to look at what people are willing to pay when they feel the wilderness is threatened. That's according to Chris Lowe, associate professor at Alaska Pacific University. Lowe wrote his PhD dissertation on the subject.
The problem with measuring this kind of a thing is that most of the time nobody has to pay for it, so nobody's going to show that it exists. If I have a desire to go up to Denali Park, I can do so, but the value I get from the park being up there and available for my enjoyment is not something I have to shell out any money for. The only time you can measure this kind of a value is when there is some threat to the continuation of that park, for example.
Lowe says Prince William Sound and other spill-affected areas, including national parks, are not only valued by local residents, they have a national significance. The national public values the Alaska wilderness even if they've never been there.
For example, the Statue of Liberty is a national treasure, if you will. And I would feel some loss if people decided to cut it down and make a McDonald's out there. People have the same reaction if something significant happens up here. So that the option value then is something that should be seen in a national context. And my suspicion is if you were able to measure it in a national context, it would be a very considerable sum of money that we'd be talking about.
The option value principle is not just something that can be applied to wilderness. You can have an option value for a bus outside your house. You may not use the bus, but you may be willing to pay a little more rent for living near the bus stop, so when your car breaks down, you can take the bus. The option value of the wilderness is difficult to measure, but one way to do so is by looking at the donations received by environmental organizations since the oil spill, and also the number of people willing to volunteer in the cleanup effort.
You try and look at their actions, and some of the actions might be spending 2 weeks paying your airfare to Washington, D.C., and lobbying your congressman or something. So then you have to translate what they did into some sort of a dollar figure. Now, if you look at the response to the oil spill, you find that there's a huge amount of volunteerism, if you will, even though they're paying them $16 and whatever it is per hour. There seems to be a tremendous willingness on the part of many non-Alaskans to try and clean the mess up, if you will.
The Natural Resources Damage Assessment Plan does propose to study the loss of intrinsic value to the wilderness, but Lowe says to properly gauge the value would require a national survey, and that would take at least a year to complete. The damage assessment teams only have 6 months to do their studies.
My hope would be that with all of these studies, they've got $2.8 million, by the way I read it, for economic studies. If they had somebody working, particularly if we could work it on a national basis to try and measure this value, this existence value, option value, whatever we want to call it, I think this would be an important part of what is supposedly the objective of this assessment. I don't think you can do it before the 28th of February, which is when everything's supposed to be done.
That's Chris Lowe, associate professor at Alaska Pacific University. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Well, yeah, and that's what's happening because it looks like the Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee's bill is going to get whipped on the floor. I'm not a party to all that maneuvering, but I know that's why it's taking place.
Are you doing anything to try to get it going again with this preemption clause blocked?
Well, sure, I think it's a natural. It's not going to stay bottled up in the Congress, but basically they're trying to work something out so that the committee chairman of the Merchant Marine and Fisheries, Representative Jones of North Carolina. Well, it's kind of a face-saving device. No committee chairman wants to lose a bill on the floor. It's a real blow.
Dr. Albert Manville says Exxon could have used three substances proven to be effective against oil spills, but chose instead to use its own relatively ineffective products.
Exxon was woefully inadequate in looking at many technologies. Granted, there were a lot of companies from all over the world that were providing products and making requests that their products be tested, but those products with proven technologies that were not Exxon products, to my knowledge and information, simply have not been tested. In a couple cases in point, Bioversal, Active 8000, and a coconut-based fiber called Woolastic. These were all tested independently, and they were shown to work, and yet Exxon has shown and didn't show any interest in using these products. And I find that a little bit difficult to swallow.
Manville says the three products collect or break down oil. He says recent tests show they are very effective and could have made a difference in the Valdez spill.
These products are now being independently tested, for example, down at the by the Homer Area Recovery Committee at their own expense, and the products seem to be working, and Exxon has claimed to have tested one, and for example, Bioversal claimed to have tested this product when indeed it was not tested in Alaska. Another product, Active 8000, they were told that the product was just unsatisfactory. It was never tested up there, and now under independent bucket tests, they're showing very, very promising results, particularly Bioversal.
Manville says Exxon did not make an honest effort to use more effective cleaning agents, and he speculates Exxon decided early on it would not make a genuine effort to clean up the spill.
I've heard Exxon officials supposedly claim that it will be cheaper for them to deal with this in the courts than it will be to actually go out and try and do an honest and concerted effort at cleaning this up. And I'm afraid I find that hard to swallow. Exxon is a company that of course, is most certainly profit-motivated. They've got many, many stockholders, and it would be to their best advantage if they want to maintain a true and sincere public relations effort to try and do a concerted effort at cleaning up and use these products and do other things and work with all the people, but they haven't been from the outset, and of course now they've pulled out, and it's academic, and it's a question of whether they're even going to be back next year.
Manville says too much money was spent on public relations and not enough on cleanup. He warns that unless Congress toughens oil spill legislation and removes liability limits for oil companies, such half-hearted cleanup efforts will continue.
We've sort of had the coyote guarding the chicken coop, if you will, and through complacency and other problems, not necessarily just Exxon's or Alyeska's fault, but just the situation up there, they were sort of asleep at the switch.
If liability limits remain, Manville recommends the creation of an independent group funded by the oil companies that would coordinate oil spill cleanups in the future. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.